From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Leanne Hansen, sitting in while Terry Gross is on vacation. On today's show, I speak with author and physician Perry Klass. Dr. Klass's new book, A Not Entirely Benign Procedure, is a chronicle of her 4 years at Harvard Medical School. Also today, a conversation with actress Clarice Taylor. She plays black comedian Moms Mabley off-Broadway and appears on The Bill Cosby Show as Cliff Huxtable's mother. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording featuring oboist Leon Goossens performing works by Edward Elgar. And humorist Alice Kahn has some thoughts on the latest skirmish in the sexual revolution. That's all coming up today on Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Perry Klass, an intern in pediatrics and a graduate of Harvard Medical School. She is also a writer, frequently contributing to Ms. Magazine, Esquire, Vogue, and Discover magazines, as well as the New York Times Hers column. She has also published a novel and a collection of short stories. During her 4 years as a medical student, Klass found the time to record her impressions, opinions, fears, and anxieties, and the result is her new book, Not an Entirely Benign Procedure, published by G.P. Putnam & Sons. She joins us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. Dr. Klass, welcome.
Thank you.
Do you want me to call you doctor? You've earned it, you know.
I'm probably more comfortable being called Perry, but I know I'm entitled to be called doctor. I get called doctor at work.
So you'd prefer to be called Perry?
Yeah.
Okay. When you applied to medical school, what reasons did you give for becoming a doctor?
Well, at the time I was a graduate student in biology, and the connection between research in biology and clinical medicine is obviously a very close one, and I gave the excuse or the argument that probably most graduate students in biology give, that while I was interested in science and I loved biology, I wanted to do something that would allow me to have a more direct connection with people and with helping people and with using it in a sort of day-to-day practical way.
It sounds like a very pat answer.
Well, it got to feel like a very pat answer because I don't know if you're familiar with the medical school application process, but you go around to interviews and you repeat yourself at 15 different schools with two or three interviewers at each school, and they each ask you that. And even if you mean it, it starts to sound like a tape recording.
Did you mean it? Were these the real reasons?
I think they were some of the real reasons. I think that, you know, medicine has a glamour, or it had a glamour to me, probably still does. I thought it would be an interesting and a worthwhile and a good life. I probably thought about it a little bit more selfishly in terms of what kind of life would I like and what kind of life would be good for me, and not just in terms of altruism and the people I might help, but it's kind of all tied up together.
Mm. Have those reasons changed at all?
Well, sometime on the long march through medical school, you have to wonder if you really want to do this and if you're just doing it because now you've put so much time and effort and money and work into it that you have to go through with it. But I think that's the sort of dark valley and you come out the other side, and yeah, those reasons stay pretty constant. And for me, at least, I found things in medicine that gave me pleasure that I wouldn't necessarily have predicted or that were rewarding for me. And I also found some things which I expected to be wonderful, which really weren't.
What were some of the good things that you found that you didn't expect to find when you were going through this procedure as a medical student?
I think the thing that I found that surprised me most was pediatrics, which wasn't something I'd planned on at all. And I really liked it. I love it. And it was sort of like finding a home.
Was this a result at all of your actually being pregnant and having a child when you were in medical school?
Probably, or at least the two things may have both been the result of my liking children more than I had originally realized, or more than I had originally thought about when I was, say, a college student or a graduate student. I'm sure they were connected in some way.
Mm. What kind of debate did this put in your own mind while you were in medical school, discovering that you were pregnant? One of the things that you write about in the book is that pregnancy is discussed in the medical curriculum as in terms of a disease, in terms of what can go wrong. You must have been very frightened.
Well, I didn't so much discover I was pregnant as I planned to be pregnant, and I sort of argued it all out in my mind beforehand. It's perfectly true, as I write about in the book, that most people in medical school haven't been pregnant or haven't had children when they're students, and the issue of pregnancy comes up in the curriculum like the issue of everything else. It comes up as a disease, and you learn everything that can possibly go wrong, from common things to extremely rare things, and you spend as much time on the rarest, most uncommon complication of pregnancy as you do on a normal pregnancy. And the argument for that, of course, is that if you are going to be a doctor, you should know about even the rarest, most remarkable complication of pregnancy, which is all very well. But it doesn't leave you with a very sane appreciation of how many pregnancies are actually normal, how many pregnancies don't end in disaster, how many pregnancies don't end in hemorrhage and death. And I think that was scary for me. I also think, as I write in the book, that it may affect how a lot of doctors look at pregnancy later on.
Because it is treated more or less as a disease as opposed to a sort of natural form of human living.
Yeah.
You write in the book in that section about actually being in a class and they're discussing different things that can go wrong. And at one point, all the students start yelling, C-section, C-section, C-section.
That was actually going on in a small group session that happened. Yeah. Though they were asking questions. What would you do in this case? We do a lot of studying in medical school that's in a case format. They tell you that, you know, so-and-so is a 24-year-old woman, and she comes to you with these symptoms, and you do these lab tests, and these are the values, and what would you get? So this was at some point where it began to seem like an awful lot of our problems were leading us to sort of C-section the person, which is reasonable. We were being presented with one problem pregnancy after another, one labor that went wrong after another.
Didn't you at any moment ever feel like standing up during your pregnancy and saying, wait a minute, this is not what it's like? Or would that have been sort of a breach of protocol or a black mark against you?
No, I talked a lot when I was pregnant. I probably always talk a lot. But, I mean, I talked about what it was like. And I think that I understood the logic of what they were teaching us. I understood why we needed to know it and know about it. I was just disturbed that the other side of the story wasn't given its weight. And, I mean, I suppose you could say that medical school is like that in general. I mean, we all live for years, and everybody lives for years and grows up, and very little of our life is spent sick, and yet medical school is all about the part of life which is spent sick. The problem is that pregnancy is something which people come to doctors for, even when the pregnancy is going right. And I guess I just felt funny that I had a pretty uneventful pregnancy, but I still went to the doctor fairly frequently, and I still had a lot of questions, and I still needed to understand a lot about what to do and how to act, and none of those questions seemed to be part of the curriculum.
Let's get to your experience of actually writing while you were in medical school. When were you asked to write about your experiences?
The first time was really right at the end of my first year of medical school. Mademoiselle magazine was going to do a special feature on being a woman in the first year of law school and business school and medical school, and they had published some of my short stories, and they knew I was a medical student, and they asked if I'd like to do the piece about being a woman in the first year of medical school. That was actually the first time I'd ever tried to write nonfiction, tried to write about my own experiences.
Was it difficult?
Yeah, it was really difficult that first time. I felt very, you know, when you write fiction, you can control things. If you don't like a character, you can kill him off or you can let him triumph. And I felt sort of confined by the fact that I had to be honest and tell the truth and I couldn't change things around.
Did it change your perspective at all? Was your perspective different from, say, that of your classmates or your teachers because you were required to be objective in writing this nonfiction piece?
I don't think I was ever required to be objective, and I don't think I would claim that I ever was objective. I told it pretty much in the first person singular. I really tried hard never to speak for my classmates or for medical students in general. If some of the things that I wrote about were fairly universal, then that's because the experience is an overwhelming one and everybody has to go through some of these segments of it. But I never tried to be objective. I think writing about anything probably changes your perspective on it a little bit by making you an observer. And when the worst, most awful things are happening to you, a little voice in your mind is sort of telling you this is going to be tremendous material. You'll write about this. You'll put it into perspective. It'll make a good story. Medical school at times got sufficiently intense that I lost that little voice, but it always came back.
How did you do it? How did you find the time to actually write about this as well as go through that grueling 4 years of medical school?
I think if I'd kept a diary all through medical school, you wouldn't find that particularly remarkable. I just got into the habit of making my day-to-day experience into short little finished essays, and I can come home and do them. It's really, in a sense, easy. That is to say, now I still do this. I write essays all the time about being a resident. If I come out of the hospital and come home and I say to you, you'll never believe what happened to me today. Today I had to tell some parents that their child has AIDS. Today I had to do something I've never done before for the first time, and I was so terrified. You know, anything I tell you about, if I think about how to present it, it's interesting, it's sort of newsy, it's juicy. And if you get in the habit of making these things into short little essays, it's just, I don't know, the material is there, always there, the material is always on my mind. I live with this all the time, and it's not such a hard thing to do.
Do you think it helps you sort of filter the experience for yourself, determine, you know, what's valuable to keep and what should be discarded?
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. It also sometimes teaches me a little bit about myself and what my values are. I mean, writing about something and taking a position on paper is scary, because there are a lot of things in medicine, as in any other field, in which there are sort of unspoken agreements, or you're allowed to waffle back and forth depending on the situation, and then there you are writing an essay and you realize that you're not going to get out of this without coming down for something that you do believe in.
And you do come down on the system a little bit. You do have your doubts about the system and criticize the system. What was your worst doubt about the system? What was something that perhaps really surprised you about the medical system, and something that you find perhaps a bit abhorrent?
I think that, and this is certainly not original with me, I think that one of the things I found most difficult and most hard to deal with and most surprising when I did adult medicine was the amount of pain I was involved in inflicting, the amount of effort that I was helping doctors put into prolonging the lives of people who I wasn't sure wanted their lives prolonged, at a cost of great pain and great suffering, and also a great deal of work for the residents and doctors. And that was one of the things I hated about adult medicine. That's one of the reasons I'm in pediatrics. And that's just it's a consequence of the way medical care is nowadays. It's a consequence also of what the public wants from medical care, I suppose, but I couldn't deal with it very well.
What the public wants from medical care. Do you think we really want all of this intervention? We really want to be kept alive at all costs?
I don't think that anybody individually, or that most people individually, want it when it comes down to it for them. But I think the system, with its tremendous ability to do sort of heroic rescues and last-minute saves and keeping people alive, the system is set up that way. I don't think just because doctors and nurses want it that way. I think that the idea that there should always be something medicine can do, that medicine should always have the power to help, that medicine should always be as heroic as possible, comes out of a kind of a dialogue between doctors and non-doctors.
It also seems to be the kind of attitude we have in, say, television shows about medicine. Marcus Welby seemed to almost always save the patient at the end.
Oh, yeah.
Did you grow up with that impression of what it was like to be a doctor?
Definitely. I was deeply into doctor shows.
Which ones were your favorites? Who did you want to be?
Oh, I don't know who I wanted to be, but I watched Marcus Welby and I watched Medical Center. And I think I grew up with that model of medicine in my mind. Everything takes about an hour, and it builds to a dramatic climax, and then you save them. And I think everybody has that a little bit in mind. People are still, people who've been sick for a very long time or have a lot of things wrong with them are still sort of shocked and hurt and wounded to feel that the doctors are giving up on them. And that's an awful thing to... That's one of the most awful things you can say to a patient, is something which conveys the message the doctors are giving up on you. It's, everyone would rather come in with, you know, more good news. There's something else we can try, something else we can do. And that's what everyone's hoping to hear.
There's even a phrase that is used to describe that sort of condition. I think it's called CTD, circling the drain.
Well, circling the drain is that I talk about in the book is one of the sort of awful examples of slang that people use in the hospital to describe patient conditions. It's not, CTD is someone who's dying, basically.
As opposed to, say, the other phrase is DNR, do not resuscitate.
Do not resuscitate is a legal term. Do not resuscitate, I talk about in the book, is a decision that a patient or a patient's family makes when they say no more heroic last-minute interventions. If somebody stops breathing, if somebody's heart stops, you let it stop. And you do not come in there with a code team and pound on the person's chest and put down a breathing tube. That's DNR is a term which refers usually to the outcome of a lot of discussions and of a medical team and a patient and a family coming to take a realistic point of view about the possibilities for ultimately helping this patient.
And you almost had to learn a whole new language, a whole new set of jargon in order to communicate, not necessarily with the patient, but more with the doctors themselves.
Oh, yeah, we have a real sort of technical babble that we talk.
Technical babble, is that more for the doctors or to maybe not let the patient know what's going on?
No, it's for the doctors. We write in it in the patient's charts, too. It's a kind of shorthand. We have a tremendous vocabulary of lab tests and diseases and conditions that we have to communicate, and it gets codified into a technical language, and then the technical language gets abbreviated to the point where some hospitals will give you a 10-page list of approved abbreviations, and you hardly even notice them anymore. And one of the results of that is that patients stop understanding you unless you make an effort to translate back into English. I suspect that's true of almost any profession. I suspect that if you had a lot of radio people together talking to each other about technical aspects of doing radio, that someone from outside the field wouldn't understand a word of it.
My guest is Dr. Perry Klass, whose new book, Not an Entirely Benign Procedure, is a collection of essays about her 4 years at Harvard Medical School. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Dr. Perry Klass. She is an intern in pediatrics, a graduate of Harvard Medical School. She's also a writer, and a collection of her essays, which were written while she was in medical school, have been collected in a book entitled Not an Entirely Benign Procedure. We were talking a little bit about language, and actually the title of your book, Not an Entirely Benign Procedure, is actually one of those phrases that doctors use when they say, look, we're going to do something that's going to hurt you, but we're going to couch it in such a way that you won't be so frightened. And that whole relationship between the patient and the doctor, I got very frightened by reading your book. It's almost as though I don't want to go into a hospital anymore because as a patient, I'm sort of, you know, the last one on the list, the lowest person in the on the totem pole. You talk about the patient as, in some cases, being the enemy, being identified with the disease that a patient has. Was this just a surprise to you that the patient is perhaps such a small entity in the entire procedure?
Well, it was a little bit of a surprise for me, but I'd never been involved in medicine from the other side before. It's not that the patient is a small entity, it's just that the mechanics of a hospital and the hierarchy of a hospital are very absorbing. And if you're the doctor, you can't help being absorbed in the doctors above you and the doctors below you and the ancillary staff and your relations with the other doctors and your relations also with nursing, which is a whole other hierarchy within the hospital. And the patient has to be sort of taken care of in this structure. And what I was writing about in the book was I was trying to write about that structure. I was trying to write about what it's like from the doctor's point of view. And what I was writing about is probably specific to teaching hospitals, maybe even to big teaching hospitals, and is probably not at all what you would find if you either went to your own doctor in your own doctor's office or else went into a small private hospital.
Did you find that there was a male hierarchy in medicine? Did you find yourself being treated differently because you were a woman, do you think?
At intervals. I mean, I'm in pediatrics, which has always been one of the fields which welcomed women, and I don't feel that very much at all in pediatrics and never have, and I think it's probably one of the reasons why I like pediatrics and feel at home there. Certainly in surgery, where, you know, I was the only female on a team of doctors who, I don't know, there would be, you know, 7 or 8 of us rushing around the place and I would be the only female. Certainly I would be conscious of that. And sometimes I would have to put up with various kinds of garbage having to do with that. And the whole hierarchy, the whole training structure feels very male. It feels like something that men would set up to train other men. And that's changing in some fields and changing less in other fields.
What fields do you think they're changing? I mean, you've mentioned pediatrics.
I think it's changing to some extent also in internal medicine, changing least probably in surgery.
You tell a very interesting joke about surgeons, actually. In fact, the entire book is kind of peppered with these anecdotes and these jokes. I think the joke is, how many surgeons does it take to change a light bulb? Why not remove the socket? It's going to give you trouble later on. Did you have a problem maintaining your sense of humor during this, your whole education?
No, I think I maintain my sense of humor. I think most medical students do. The difficulty is it gets a little bit twisted, and things which would not have seemed funny to you at the beginning seem hysterically funny to you by the end, and you catch yourself laughing at something or, you know, telling a joke which is either at the expense of the patient or concerns somebody's pain, and sometimes you wonder exactly what's happened to you. I think everyone understands that this humor is a very necessary defense. If you're going to work in a place where people are in pain and people are dying, and you're going to stick needles, say, into people who are in pain and people who are dying, at some point you need the ability to laugh at yourself and at what you're doing. It's a very necessary part of staying alive for the doctor. Medicine or pediatrics, a lot of it is, in essence, very heroic in the sense that you are helping people and you are saving kids, and kids got sick and they'll go home better. But at 2 a.m, if what you're doing is sticking needles into a screaming 3-year-old, you have to have some way to maintain yourself. You have to have some way to remember that you are not actually in this business because you like torturing small children. And if you look up from the screaming 3-year-old and say to the nurse who is helping hold down the screaming 3-year-old, and you say to her, I went into this business because I enjoy torturing small children, that kind of black humor is sometimes necessary to get you through the night, because it really is necessary to do what you're doing.
Is it also necessary to help you get over the fact that perhaps you lose a patient, or there's nothing that you can do for a patient? I mean, it's not like you can leave your work in the hospital and then go home and forget about it.
No, it's not. There are a lot of different ways that people deal with the patients that we can't help or the patients that we lose. And it varies from doctor to doctor, and it varies from patient to patient. There are patients who die and your only reaction is grief because you had come to care about them and you grieve. There are patients who die and you're angry because you sort of feel that if a few little things had gone differently, maybe it wouldn't have happened. There are patients who die and you're not so emotionally involved and you're able to be interested in what happened. It depends a lot on who you are. I think in pediatrics, nobody is tough enough or detached enough or wants to be tough enough that the death of a child can just pass by. I think there are people who can do that with adult deaths, or at least there are people in adult medicine who I felt did that. And many adult deaths, especially people who are very old and very sick, it's hard to feel that, you know, this is something which should have been avoided, this is something which should never have happened. But when infants die, or when 3- and 4-year-olds die, or when adolescents die, there isn't any way to sort of say, oh, you know, it was bound to happen today or tomorrow or next week.
You talk about death in one of the chapters in the book entitled Issues, and how sometimes the doctor wishes that the patients would just, you know, die with dignity, die the way they died, and say, you know, Little Women, as opposed to fighting it, or as opposed to making a big scene, or even cracking jokes about it.
Well, that's not exactly what I meant, I guess. I guess I thought that in books, in storybooks and in books about other centuries, sometimes if a person was somewhat lucky, people got the chance to have some control over who they were when they were dying. If you were a certain kind of person, you could continue to be that kind of person as long as you possibly could. Whereas in the hospital, between the things that we do to people and the tubes that we put down and the ways that we prevent them from thinking straight and speaking straight and hearing what goes on around them, you really are deprived of that individuality. You spend your last moments frequently in a kind of anonymity. You are just a sick patient, a very sick patient, because we've stripped you of the wherewithal to go out as yourself. And I think that's too bad in a lot of ways, but sometimes unavoidable.
One of the things you mention is that the legal status of a medical student is unclear. The medical student can end up doing procedures that, say, a nurse can't do. And one of the things you don't discuss is the whole issue of malpractice now, and the idea of, you know, you as a doctor buying malpractice insurance and the high instances of malpractice suits against doctors. Is this a big concern now?
It's a tremendously big concern. It's not a concern which has a great deal of impact on your life as a medical student or a resident. As a resident, you are in training, and your training program is responsible for you as a medical student. As I said, it's a little bit ambiguous, but you are not individually expected to arrange for malpractice. It's something which people talk about a lot. They talk about when they think about what specialties they're going to go into and which are the ones where you inevitably do get sued. And we make jokes about it all the time when, say, a patient gets referred in from another hospital and we're looking at the record and it seems to us that something was not done right at the other hospital. We make a lot of jokes about malpractice, but it doesn't actually come up in my life. I don't pay my own premiums yet.
Do you think the whole system of medical education should be reevaluated?
It is being reevaluated. It's always being reevaluated. I think it would be nice to see it change. I don't think that the 4 years that I put in were necessarily spent optimally, but I don't know if I have enough perspective yet to design it. I think I could design it very well now so that it would be perfect for me, but I don't know if I have enough perspective to design it so that it would also be good for the incipient surgeons and for the incipient dermatologists and, you know, for people who bring different things to it and want different things from it.
One of the things that has been suggested is perhaps reducing the hours that a resident or an intern is on call, because there's this grueling schedule that they have to follow, which you had to follow.
Yeah. Well, no resident is going to give you an argument about that. I mean, residents will agree to anything if it gets them a little more sleep and a little more time out of the hospital. But again, I think that we would all actually want to see the plan of what we were going to do and how it was going to affect our education and how it was going to affect our time off. I mean, we tend to be very suspicious, and we tend to feel that, you know, they're going to start a shift system and they're going to say that you can only work 12 hours a day, and we're going to walk in on day one and they're going to say, "Hi, Perry, you're working 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. for the next 365 days. You know, we tend to be sort of paranoid that somehow it will all work out so that we're working more.
Do you think you'll be able to maintain a balance between medicine and writing? Chekhov did.
Well, I don't know how relevant that is to me being able to do it, but I hope so. I hope so. I don't know exactly what kind of a doctor I'm going to be or what kind of a life I'm going to have inside medicine, but certainly in arranging it, I'm going to be mindful of the fact that I want to keep writing.
Dr. Perry Klass, thank you very, very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
My guest has been writer and physician Perry Klass. In her new book, she writes about her experiences as a medical student. It's titled Not an Entirely Benign Procedure and is published by Putnam. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with physicist and author James Trefill. He'll unravel some of the mysteries of the universe, including the answer to the age-old question, why is the sky blue? So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. from Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air. I'm Leanne Hansen, sitting in while Terry Gross is on vacation. Coming up, actress Clarice Taylor. She's starring off Broadway in Moms, a play based on the life of comedian Moms Mabley. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Elgar Miniatures, a recording of the British composer's works featuring oboist Leon Goossens. And humorous Alice Kahn examines what happens when popular culture and gynecology meet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, has a profile of the British oboist Leon Goossens, featuring a piece written for Goossens by the late British composer Edward Elgar. Orchestral works with solos for oboe are rare, so Lloyd says this work and its performance are treasures.
The greatest oboe player of this century, no one else comes even close, is Leon Goossens. He's probably best known as the first oboist in the pre-war London Philharmonic Orchestra. With its conductor, Sir Thomas Beecham, handpicking the players, it was perhaps the most perfect orchestra ever assembled. And it was by the Goossens oboe that you could immediately identify the old London Phil. Goossens is the Olivier of musicians. His oboe doesn't just play the notes. It sings them and talks them and recites them. The way Goossens turns a phrase gets etched in your memory. You know no one will ever play a passage like that again, that no one else's version will have the color, the drama, the intimacy, the long-breathed rhythmic daring. The first time I ever thought that Swan Lake, for example, might actually be great music was after I heard the uncanny phrasing by Leon Goossens of the mysterious Swan theme. Not many London Philharmonic records are available in this country anymore, and little of Goossens' solo work remains in the catalog. But recently, a friend of mine discovered a remarkable recording on the British Chandos label. It's called Elgar Miniatures. It's a charming selection of Elgar's early works, or later works based on early sketches. They're all sweetly melancholy and pastoral in tone, nothing over 5 minutes long, and all lovingly performed by Norman Del Mar and the Bournemouth Sinfonietta. But the great thing on the disc is a 3-minute and 50-second piece with Leon Goossens as guest soloist called Soliloquy for Oboe, recorded a little over a decade ago when Goossens was 79. In 1933, the year before Elgar died, he conducted one of his early overtures with the London Philharmonic. Later, when he heard the recording, he was overwhelmed with Goossens' playing of the oboe passages. Half a century earlier, Elgar had written oboe solos for his gifted younger brother, whom he outlived. Now Elgar was inspired to compose a suite for oboe and orchestra for Goossens. He didn't live to finish it, but one movement existed in short score with full indications for what he wanted the orchestra to do. Goossens asked composer Gordon Jacob to flesh out the orchestration. It's probably Elgar's last work, certainly one of his most poignantly beautiful and yearning.
Thank you.
Leon Goossens playing Elgar's soliloquy for oboe. That was its first recording. There won't be a better one.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. The recording featured in his review is Elgar Miniatures on the British label Chandos. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress Clarice Taylor. You may know her as Cliff Huxtable's mother on The Bill Cosby Show. But now she's playing everybody's mom in her new off-Broadway play about the life of black comedian Moms Mabley. Moms Mabley died in 1975 when she was 81. On stage, Moms broke up audiences with her racy jokes about men and her fictional conversations with world leaders. Moms had been performing for more than 50 years before she was discovered by white audiences. She was a longtime headliner at the Apollo Theater in Harlem, and that's where Clarice Taylor first saw her.
I was sitting in the Apollo many times when she would be performing. She's one of my stars. You know, in those days, we had something like the Chitlin Circuit, you know, TOBA, Theater Owners Booking Association. They were the ones that booked colored acts because we couldn't go down to downtown. We had no artists down there, and we were not welcome. You see, they were our stars long before they became, they did the crossover.
So you used to sit in the audience and laugh
and fall out. And we just, you know, you just always knew Moms Mabley, that's all. And if somebody heard a joke, they'd say, did you hear the latest Moms Mabley joke? And they would tell you that. And even if you'd heard it, you'd still laugh and say, well, yeah, but did you hear this one? And then they would tell you another one. And it was a lot of, it, that's the way it was.
She developed this reputation as kind of being a dirty old lady, you know, and being raunchy. But
wait a minute, just hold it here. This is, you're right. But in those days, raunchy was not what's raunchy in these days. She was a Sunday school teacher when you hear her records compared to what you hear now. She never used a dirty word. She never talked about her personals like you just hear right out now. And she did do double innuendo things. And we thought that was so risque. We thought they were. And they were in those days. You couldn't repeat her jokes just openly. Of course, today you could say them in Sunday school.
Her whole stage presence, wearing the baggy dress and the hat.
And the big shoes always on the wrong foot. And the colorful stockings.
Was this the persona that she always had on stage, even when she started way back at the time when she was...
As far back as I can remember. Mm. As far back, she always had these... I didn't remember her wearing a wig, because I guess that was something that happened before I was born. And I think her wig and her... I got that she did blackface. I got that from my research. And I got the wig from my research. But I don't remember ever seeing her in a red wig.
How much research did you have to do to...
I worked on this about 2-3 years before I even got it into any condition.
Did you find out things that you hadn't expected about her?
I certainly did. I didn't expect anything. You know, when you have an idol, you don't expect... You don't think whether they're married or whether they maybe sometimes have to have a cold. Or you just don't think of things like that. But then when I went to a bookstore, you know, and just, we go to the big New York bookstore and says, I would like to have all the books that you have on Moms Mabley. He said, there are none.
Mm.
Then I said, well, okay, you know, that didn't discourage me. So I went flying up to the Schomburg Library, which have all the data, all the books on all the blacks, nothing. And I finally traced down some old jets that I found in the jet that she had been raped at 11 years old and that she had three daughters.
There's a little scene that you do in the play where her family is really expressing disapproval of her.
Her brother, yes. Her brother was the one that disapproved of her doing wearing blackface with the big lips and all. And he came and asked her to change her name.
You know, as much personal tragedy as Moms Mabley went through, you never had any indication of it when she was on stage.
Never. And this is what our story is about. That, you know, you don't even think of people that make you laugh, that whether they're just coming from burying their own child, their only child, or whether they've just been mugged or just had, you know, unless they're sick enough to go to the hospital. You never know what tragedy, but yet you got to go out and you have to be funny, and you have to do it.
The audience itself that comes to see the play, what a wide range of people. You've got elderly black people, elderly white people, young white people, young black people.
Yes.
I mean, what was it about Moms that made her so popular straight across the board?
You know, I didn't realize that she was so loved until I started this project. You know, people meet me on the street and they come up, they say, "Can I kiss you? Moms, can I kiss you?" Oh, I knew Moms Mabley. I love Moms Mabley. And the young people in the audience, when they meet me afterward, they said, "I'm bringing my mother. My mother had those records, and my father, and I'll be back. I'm bringing my family." Because Moms, they have told me all their my life about Moms.
She also never seemed to forget her roots, even though she would drive her Rolls Royce into Harlem, you know, to buy the collard
greens. Every week she came into Harlem to buy. This I got from her children, and her housekeeper also.
There is a little section that you do about when she's in Harlem and she is mugged. Essentially, she gets held up.
Oh,
you know that one?
Yeah. This handsome young man meets her on the street. He says, "You Moms Mabley?" She said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, Moms, you got to help me. I ain't got no money. I ain't got no mother. I ain't got no father. I ain't got no place to stay. I ain't got none in this world but this gun." And I had to help him. And then he went to searching all over me, and I said, "Oh, son, please, I didn't give you every penny I had, but if you hit one more spot, I'm going to write you a check."
You know, I had no idea she was so politically aware.
Oh, yes, and she did stand on the street corners with Adam Clayton Powell, you know. And got him elected. I mean, helped to get him elected. She was very staunch. And she would talk about Khrushchev and Castro. And she would just tell it in such a humorous way.
Didn't she have a routine about how she wasn't going to be leaving her job at the UN because she had to be there to hold the door open when the Russians walked out?
Right.
There seems to be some similarities between your own career and Mom's career. You've had a very distinguished career in the theater. On television, everybody knows you now as Bill Cosby's mother on the Cosby Show. And it seems like you're gaining a bit of national importance now, rather late in life, just like Moms.
Isn't that nice?
It is nice.
I love it. It's just like you've just been through a long training period and you suddenly feel like you're going to get a degree. I love it because I think things happen to you when you're ready for them. I think it's just almost a punishment for things to happen. And I have had the good fortune to have been able to make a living at my craft. And this is not always, you know, 90% of actors out of work at any given moment. There's only very few of us that get through. And I worked for the government for 20 years.
You did?
While I was doing theater. I worked from 12 at night till 8:30 in the morning. I ran and did theater all day and rehearsed and so forth. I never had any sick leave, never had any vacation. Everything was used up in the theater. So I just feel like those were wonderful years. I made a living. And I didn't make as much money then as I'm making now. But remember, this is only money. I still was on the stage doing what I love to do.
Mm-hmm. Clarice Taylor, thank you so much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Clarice Taylor is currently appearing in the off-Broadway production of Moms at the Astor Place Theater in New York City. One footnote. Clarice Taylor first appeared as Moms Mabley in a play written by Alice Childress, which was performed at the Hudson Guild Theater. The play was commissioned by Clarice Taylor. The play, now at the Astor Place Theater, was written by Ben Caldwell. Alice Childress claims that this current production plagiarizes her original work. When we spoke to Miss Taylor, she said that the original play written by Miss Childress is fiction, while the new play sticks to the facts. At this time, no legal action is planned by Miss Childress. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. John Hockenberry, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, John.
Hi, Leanne. How are you?
I'm fine. What stories do you have today?
On the program tonight, Deborah Amos reports from Tehran on a tour of minesweeping operations in Iran. Also, she talks to us a little bit what it's like to be in Iran since the revolution. And we talk with both sides in the South African miners' strike, a representative of Anglo-American Corporation, one of the largest mine operators, and also the head of the Black Miners Union. And also at the Pan Am Games, weird sports.
What do you mean, weird sports? Something synchronized?
Bowling, perhaps? No. We have all kinds of odd things, odd medal contender sports at the Pan Am Games. How about team handball?
I've never heard of it, but I will. Thanks, John. All Things Considered is coming up later on National Public Radio. Our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, is on vacation, so we've asked humorist Alice Kahn to join us. She has some thoughts on the G-spot. She recently read that the spot's existence has been called into question. So where does that leave a society that's spent so much time searching for it?
We live in such unstable times. The words in and out are used more frequently than true and false. You remember the G-spot, an anatomical discovery that was greeted by women's magazines the way physicists greeted nuclear fission? The spot's existence received national attention 5 years ago. Information about the G-spot erupted in a veritable Vesuvius of anatomical curiosity. I was one of the curious, for personal as well as scientific reasons. It seems the author of the book was a woman with two-thirds the same name as mine, one Alice Kahn Ladas. As a result, people began to confuse the two of us. At cocktail parties, when I'd introduce myself as a writer, I would invariably be subjected to a knowing wink and a comment like, "G-spot lady, you free tonight?" You must remember that 5 years ago was a peak time in the paperback sexual revolution, an era when we not only accepted the idea that women should experience orgasm, but expected that the orgasms had gosh darn better be whoppers. Numerous books appeared guiding women to the best, the most complete, the total, and even something men could only dream about, the multiple. It seems only natural that all this resulted in the current love too much backlash. Another result is that the once disputed spot is being disputed again. Research published in a recent issue of the Journal of Sex and Marital Therapy by professors in Colombia and Israel, think of their phone bills, concludes, evidence in support of the G-spot is so far inconclusive. Attention, women of the world! Abandon your search. The G-spot is located 5 centimeters south of Never Never Land. Most of the professor's quarrel has to do with the sensational language that entered the "does G exist" debate. In particular, they object to the use of analogs like female ejaculation and female penis. They go so far as to cite in their scientific paper a book by literary critic I.A. Richards on the meaning of meaning. And they're certainly right. It's linguistic sexism of the rankest kind. Nobody, for example, would think of calling a nose the male breast. But this trend slave is bothered by one little thought. I can understand the ephemeral nature of fads in fashion, in household items, in automobiles, but you'd think an anatomical part would have a little more staying power. Our bodies are now changing as much as ourselves. Thanks to Alice Kahn-Lados, millions of women searched for spots like desperate bargain seekers at a White Flower Day sale. No one wanted to come out empty-handed. What could be more a sign of the times than an anatomy fad? It's the ultimate answer to the question, what's hot and what's not?
Alice Kahn is a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. Her latest book is a collection of essays called My Life as a Gal. She spoke to us from Pacifica Station, KPFA, in Berkeley, California. Here's a look at the next fresh air. On our next show, I'll speak with television producer Hugh Wilson. He's returning to the small screen this fall with Frank's Place, a sitcom set in a New Orleans restaurant. He directed the big screen hits Police Academy and Burglar. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review Sentimental Hygiene, the new album by Warren Zevon. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review No Way Out, the Washington thriller starring Gene Hackman and Kevin Costner. So I hope you can join us. We'd like to thank the people who help make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblidis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show, and I'm Leanne Hansen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.